I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory.
One of the reasons that population is so hard to register is that the world that you were born into, that's the world as far as you know. And there's a lot of people in that world. And to you, this is what the world normally looks like. It is not normal. The human population right now is abnormal for the reasons that I mentioned. We use some artful technology to make our population explode. And, you know, again, if the planet were limitless, as the planet really effectively was through much of human history, that's how we expanded and grew beyond our African origins, you know, all the way to the Americas, which we discovered and settled around 15,000 years ago. I mean, you know, we've never been up against limits before. The concept of limits doesn't really exist in ecology until a species learns it the hard way when you exceed them. I'm Alan Wiseman. I am a journalist and a writer. I've been accused of writing literary nonfiction. I became a journalist because everything in the world interested me and I couldn't decide on what to specialize in. So as a journalist, I get to stick my nose in all kinds of things. But I'd say over the past 25 years, more and more, I've been focusing on the global environment. And by environment, I mean, you know, pretty much everything that exists. But certainly the environment also in the sense that most people understand it as the natural foundation of this planet, its waters, its air, and how they support life, including the life of our own species. And I've been ultimately very interested in how our own species is going to continue to survive on this planet.
Alan, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thanks very much, Rick, for having me.
So I've heard on a number of occasions you've described the 21st century as the make or break century for humanity. And you've laid out a number of existential crises that we're facing. Could you start by summarizing what are we up against? Why is this the make or break century?
Well, in my new book, Hope Dies Last, I kind of spell it out as four different existential crises, though actually the three and four are pretty much the same crisis. The first one is the climate. This is no secret to anybody on Earth right now that we're changing the weather patterns all over the Earth. And yes, there are some people who deny that humans have the power to change the climate, but frankly, you know, either they are lying to themselves or they are lying to us because they're making so much money off of the reason why the climate is changing. And that is that we have energized our civilization in a very spectacular way. I mean, you and I wouldn't be talking to each other over, these electronic instruments if it weren't for the energizing of civilization, but we've done it by burning things, and burning things now are starting to catch up with us. At a certain point, the climate crisis is going to run out of our control to be able to manage it or to at least rein it in enough to ensure our continuing survival. Second, species loss. One of the inadvertent results of the human race being so successful on this planet is that we are literally pushing every other species off the planet. The principal reason we're doing that leads me to what I consider the third and fourth existential crises. For reasons that I explain in a recent book of mine, Countdown, in the 20th century, we became so successful that we quadrupled our population on this planet in a single century. And that's almost unprecedented for any large animal in the history of Earth. The reason that we were able to do that, there are a couple of them. One is modern medicine. But most important is that we discovered how to create much more, how to grow much more plant life on this planet than nature ever could. And we, in ecology, anytime you create more food, which is what we've done by creating more grains that we consume, population always rises to meet the food supply. So as a result, nearly half the planet now that's not frozen is devoted to feeding just one species, ourselves. And that's what's pushing other species off the edge, because we're taking up their habitats. We're also growing our food with chemistry that is injurious to their survival. And ultimately to our own, because we evolved alongside those species. What they contribute to the ecosystem is part of what sustains us. And because ecology and nature are so vast, there's a lot of variables out there, it's pretty hard to know what we are going to touch next that may result in a cascade of events that ultimately comes back to bite us. So that's what we're facing right now. I mean, pretty much we've grown so numerous and so successful that we've become too much of a good thing, and the planet is bursting at its seams.
Okay, so one of the challenges of this is when you're dealing with such an apocalyptic topic, how do you engage people? How do you keep people reading? How do you encourage them to want to try to react in a positive way to this? And what I noticed, at least in two of the three books that I read, in The World Without Us, in your most recent book, Hope Dies Last, is you refer to Eden in both cases, an Eden in Europe with this one of the last vestiges of the old growth forests in Europe, and then an Eden in the Middle East. And to me, I thought Alan is playing on this memory theme. He's finding this really symbolic memory reference, and he's using that to try to pull in readers rather than just laying out a disaster scenario. And I don't know whether you thought about it that way when you began both those books. Was that a device that you thought could allow you to connect with readers?
Absolutely. You know, the environmental crisis is really scary, and it's really depressing. People feel very helpless, and it's really hard to get people to read about it, because, you know, reading is an investment of time, usually our leisure time. And who wants to relax reading about something that says, you know, if we don't change our ways, maybe we're all going to die. So with The World Without Us, I kind of played a trick. I just killed us off right in the very beginning, in ways that were remotely possible, so it didn't scare readers into thinking this was going to happen right away, like, you know, Jesus or space aliens weren't going to come down and spirit us away, rapture us right off. Though, you know, I wrote The World Without Us in 2007, and then we had a major pandemic that everyone remembers. That's in very recent memory. And since one of the possibilities that and it's the most likely one, is that a Homo sapien specific virus would just attack us and leave everything else intact. And we started seeing evidence of that when our streets got very quiet and wildlife started roaming in our cities. So it was right after my publisher had put out a 15th anniversary edition of the book, which was very opportune. But getting back to your question about Eden, I always have in mind when I am writing, what's going to, attract readers the most, what's going to grab readers right off the beginning. And three of the world's major religions, have this story of Eden. Actually, when you understand history, you know that the story of Eden is not something that began with the Hebrew Bible. It began with the Sumerians and then, the Akkadians and the Babylonians. These have been around as long as civilization. And the whole concept of faith, even if people don't follow an organized religion, the concept grabs us in the gut. It's very meaningful. It's either a childhood memory that was imbued in us, or it's something that we long for, the idea of a paradise. So in The World Without Us, what I showed is that we have a memory of a time when was not divided into nature and civilization, but a point when we all sprung from beautiful, pristine, natural areas that probably most of us alive have never seen anything that perfect, but fragments of them remain. And I went to a fragment in Poland, on the Poland-Belarusian border. That's a fragment of the original primeval European forest. And when you get in there, there's a sense. This was my experience and the experience of others who have visited since then because they read my book, is that something in you recognizes something that on one hand seems so exotic, seeing enormous versions of the trees that you grew up with if you grew up in a temperate climate. But it just feels right somehow.
Primordial memory, almost like a primordial memory.
Yeah. And in my recent book, The World, Hope Dies Last, I intentionally went to what is described in the Bible as the original Garden of Eden. The Bible describes the confluence of four rivers, and it names the Tigris and Euphrates. And the other two rivers, there's been debate about them and some misconceptions about them, but archaeologists make a convincing case for one of them to be the Karun River that comes out of southwestern Iran and the other, the Wadi al-Badi that comes through Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. The confluence was the top of the Persian Gulf. And as I point out in the book, when you read about creation in the Judeo-Christian Bible, it doesn't really seem like a universe being created 13.6 billion years ago, which science now tells us is approximately the age of our universe. But it certainly resembles the end of the Pleistocene. And at the end of the Pleistocene, these four rivers existed and they were coming together, but the Persian Gulf was much lower than it is today because most of the moisture in the world was still locked up in these huge glaciers. And as a result, the top third of the Persian Gulf was a quadruple river delta, and a river delta is one of the most fertile areas that we have on Earth. And for our hunter-gatherer ancestors, this would have been a paradise. There would have been all this game, and there would have been all these plants to eat, including the ancestral versions of wheat, for example. And we would gather the seed to eat it. Sometimes, you know, we'd gather a lot of it and we'd drop some of it. And then, oh, look, it all sprouted there. And that was the beginning of agriculture. And the game that we would hunt, at some point we realized that if instead of hunting it, that we use vines to trap it and then to confine it in an area, we could just eat it at our leisure rather than having to hunt every day. And lo and behold, we also found out that game would procreate in confinement. So then suddenly we had animal husbandry. So it's no secret that, you know, in the Bible, there's these two contradictory creation tales. One of them, God gives us everything on earth to gather, basically. But in the second one, which starts in the second verse of Genesis. Suddenly we are tillers of the soil. We are stewards of the land. We are namers of all the animals, some of which are domestic for our use, some of which are wild. Well, you know, this stuff is all in our memory. So I start the book in that place because it has such an emotional impact, both as the cradle of religion and as the cradle of civilization. And the fact that, you know, the seas, as those glaciers melted and the seas began to rise, then suddenly we had flood stories. Again, the Sumerians, the Akkadians, the Judeo-Christian Bible talk about this flood. Well, today those seas are rising again, and that's because the way that we create energy is overheating the atmosphere, and it's overheating the seas, and they're expanding, and they're rising, and it's also the temperature is also rising to a point where it's becoming very difficult to live down there. So in the cradle of civilization and so much of our belief systems is becoming unlivable, that's something that we should be paying attention to.
This hook, maybe, of an Eden in the Middle East with your current book, an Eden in Europe with The World Without Us, is a hook in part to draw readers in. It's a way of making the environment, giving people a connection, making it meaningful to them. But there's also this powerful theme of forgetting. So when I read through, and this comes up in different ways, but this is the main idea of The World Without Us. What would the world be like if we were basically forgotten? If we disappeared tomorrow, what would happen? And I saw that as, are you trying to trigger people in a different way to get them to think, well, you know, don't you want to be part of the picture? Look how easily you could be erased from the planet. Because typically the way we look at these crises that we're facing is it's a crisis of the planet itself is going to end up a smoldering ruin. And you take a different angle on this, that the planet actually could be fine. And we really need to be focused on ourselves because will be erased before the planet will.
Yeah, that turns out to be the truth. And that's what I discovered when I was researching The World Without Us. I mean, at one point I was with one of the world's extinction experts, Doug Irwin. He was at the Smithsonian at the time. The Smithsonian, which is trying to erase a lot of memories these days selectively. As he explained to me, you know, this is something a lot of us know, that, you know, there have been five major extinction events in the history of this planet. They've all been caused either by volcanic eruptions of huge proportions or long durations that have ejected so much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And in some case, the biggest one, the Permian extinction, came right up through the Carboniferous layer. So it was burning a lot of coal. The atmosphere changes and a lot of things can't survive and they go extinct. I mean, fortunately, a few things manage to stick around and, like a few weeds or in one case, the last vertebrate left on Earth was, a tiny tooth worm was our ancestor. But after eons pass, millions of years, eventually that, those weeds, they decay and they leave enough organic matter that soil gets rebuilt and plants get rebuilt, et cetera. But his point, it's either volcanism or an asteroid strike can change things on this planet enormously. But life has been incredibly resilient. In some ways, I can really relate to the creationists, who believe that there must be some higher power behind all this because life is so mysterious. And we still scientifically can't describe life, nor can we recreate it. But ultimately, after each extinction event, the planet has come back, and it flourishes. And sometimes you have these, like enormous creatures like the reptiles who for 165 million years, by contrast, we've only been around for a million or so, 165 million years, they luxuriated in this very, very tropical planet, where, by the way, there was about four times the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than there is now, until an asteroid strike almost erased everything again. Each time the planet comes back. And that's really, really comforting to me in some ways, because the extinction event that we are now perpetrating on this planet, of which if we keep pushing it far enough. I mean, think of it as, each time we lose a species, it's like pulling out a foundation brick from the environmental base that supports us all. And at a certain point, you pull out too many foundation bricks and the building topples all, and you're crushed by it. And that's where we will be headed if we keep eliminating so many species. I'm comforted to know that the planet will exist beyond us. But I didn't write The World Without Us because I want a world without us. I like my species. My best friends are Homo sapiens. I was hoping that readers would see how beautifully the Earth would be restored if we vanished. Here's a really good example. One of the reasons that I can sum up in two words why a lot of people, except for environmentalists who already know about this, why most people don't want to read about the environment. The words are environmental impact. I mean, it's automatically makes us feel guilty. We are doing something to the Earth. And that phrase is very off-putting, and it exists in almost all the environmental literature that's written. Because obviously, that's why we talk about the environment. We're having an impact on it. In The World Without Us, I never use those words. I never have to, because I just theoretically remove us to see how would nature respond without all the pressures that we're heaping on this planet. Daily, hourly. And what we would leave behind if suddenly we went poof is the sum total of our environmental impact. Instead, what I'm showing people though is, okay, there's all this stuff lying around. And I pose two interesting questions. What's going to happen next, and how long will our traces remain? What of our stuff is going to last the longest? Will any of it last till the end of time? But also, how will nature perform without us? And it turns out nature performs very well. It can swiftly, if not erase all of our traces, it can bury them, or it can accommodate them to flourish anew. It's really a rather beautiful picture. But what I was hoping that people would read that and say, wow, that's amazing. But is there any way that we can add ourselves back into that picture, only this time in balance with the rest of nature? And, you know, my subsequent books have been about, okay, what do we need to do to find that balance?
So again, you mentioned people generally are focused more on their own lives. They're the main actor in their own personal drama. So if you write a book about the world going on without us, being fine without us, it's a way of implicating people. People want to live on in memory. They have kids, they build structures, they want to be remembered. And you show, well, the illusion of what we've done can be erased pretty quickly, whether it's New York City, a refinery, whatever it is, it's gone within a matter of time. Maybe that is a wake-up call to want to stick around a little longer.
Well, you know, I try to remind people of these things. Look, you and I are just as much caught up in our own lives as everybody else is caught up in theirs. Again, we are hardwired to feel this way. Remembering history takes an effort. It takes an effort to, you know, to go to places. You know, at one point in Hope Dies Last, one of my characters in this book, was a real human being, goes to Uruk, which is in southern Iraq. It was the capital of the Sumerian Empire. It was the first real city on this planet. And it lasted and thrived from the dawn of civilization to after the birth and death of Jesus Christ. 5,000 years, this city was intact. And now most of it is buried under the sands of Iraq, because its lifeblood for many years, you know, for millennia, was the Euphrates River. But eventually, as all rivers do, the Euphrates carried so much silt down that it sort of changed its course. It pushed away from Uruk. And today, it takes the effort of archaeologists to uncover it, to realize that we were looking at truly the dawn of everything that we consider to be civilized. I mean, the dawn of machinery, that's where the wheel was invented. The dawn of communication and thought, that's where writing was invented, in the city of Uruk. And today, most people wouldn't even recognize the name of that place, you know, if I didn't explain what it was. And so I explain it in my book, in showing someone very present today, contemplating, you know, how quickly everything can be erased and will be erased unless we use that knowledge to learn from these lessons of history. But memory in this case takes a real effort.
One of the recurring themes, I thought, was that we forget this long history of humanity having no breaks, right? And then this is a big theme throughout your work, is that the real problem is that there's no limit to our consumption. And we think that this is something modern, but actually it goes far back in time. And you talk about this extinction theory with the mammals around the globe. And what happens early on, you talk about Mayan civilization, how that vanishes and gets swallowed up by nature. So you have multiple examples going back in time of people and civilizations just overreaching and being forgotten, erased as a result.
You know, before we started recording this session, you were talking to me about how I talk about how important it is to for people to take children out into nature, to imprint them with this. I mean, nature does all the work. Once you're out there, it grabs you. It's fascinating because we are all part of nature. When we talk about human nature, I mean, half of that phrase is nature. But another thing that I always tell people is to take your kids to museums, take them to libraries, take them to concerts, take them to theater, take them to galleries so they can see some of the finest expressions of humanity. Because when kids start learning about the things that we have done to nature and how we're driving species into extinction, one of their reactions is going to be anger. They're going to be angry at people in the past for overreaching, for overconsuming, for doing all those things. Guilt is not going to help us solve any of these problems. We have to accept the fact that this is not just a human trait. Every animal will consume. I mean, go outside. You'll hear the birds singing, but watch what they're doing. They're looking for food. They will eat all day long until it's too dark. And if, you know, locusts will, you know, invade a field. They will eat all the crops until all the food is gone. Then they will suffer a population crash, just as will happen to us. So this is something that happens in nature continually, is that a species will grow, it will exceed its limits, and then it will die back. Humanity will not be any different. But we shouldn't, you know, it's too easy. I hear environmentalists do this all the time, to say, you know, overconsumption is the problem, so we just have to consume less. Well, I mean, come on. As, you know, as the great ecologist Paul Ehrlich often quips, there's no condom for consumption. We all do it. The two most consumed products on this planet are ones that you and I and every other person who's listening to this is addicted to. And that is energy. We're using it right now to talk to each other. And food. We can't get along without it. And it's the way we are producing energy right now, by burning things. And by the way, we do have alternatives. I talk about them in my books. We have mature alternatives that we can be using right now. But burning things is, here's an analogy for what we're doing. You would not take an apple and shrink wrap it and then leave it out in the sun, because pretty soon, you know, it would get hot because the plastic is holding in that heat, and it would develop those mushy brown spots, and then it would rot. Well, that's pretty much what we're doing with our planet right now, because when we burn things, we are releasing three different invisible gases. One of them is carbon dioxide, most famously and most prominently, but the other two, methane, which is a byproduct of how we mine stuff to burn, it doesn't last as long as carbon dioxide, but it holds in heat up to 80 times more efficiently than carbon dioxide, and much more efficient than that, up to 250 times, is nitrous oxide, which gets released with the soil because of our petroleum-derived fertilizers, which go back to how it is that we managed to grow so much food during the 20th century to increase our population so much. When that stuff breaks down in the soil, a reaction with soil microbes releases nitrous oxide. Those gases are basically shrink wrapping our planet right now. And, you know, this is ultimately going to, you know, imperil. It's already imperiling our existence. So, you know, you have to take into account the human tendency to just, you know, think right now in the present, but that's also a tendency of all organisms. So we should not just be blaming ourselves. What we have to understand is that we're the first organism that has ever proliferated to the extent that we are changing the environment, possibly to the point of ultimately, you know, cutting out the ground underneath our very feet. We have the knowledge of what we're doing, of what to do about this. What we need now is to kick that knowledge up into wisdom to actually take those actions.
And one of the things that, we can do, which you come to at the end of The World Without Us, and is the focus of Countdown, is family planning. We can have fewer kids. And you've mentioned already that the rate of population growth, there's been nothing like this in history. And a lot of that has to do with science, but the biggest part, and I've heard you describe the innovations in fertilizers as the greatest scientific revolution in history, that our ability to produce to produce much more than we've ever been able to in the past has really caused this exponential growth in population, even, you know, regardless of multiple world wars. And there's only so many people on the planet that we can feed. And you talk about family planning, but that gets wrapped up in lots of memory issues, because there are lots of horrific 20th century reminders of where that can go wrong. There are cultures that's a part of that. So I guess on the one hand, what are the different factors that complicate family planning? And a lot of it has to do with power. And you refer to institutions like the Vatican. You look at places like Israel and Palestine. What gets in the way? Where has that not worked out? And then where has family planning worked out in some spectacular ways? Places that you might not expect it. Places like Iran. Places like Thailand.
Well, you know, population is a very loaded topic, because like every other species, we are, you know, hardwired to make copies of ourselves. You know, procreation is one of the most natural acts on this planet. It's one of the most pleasurable acts on this planet. And we do it. Every other species do it. You know, the birds and the bees do it. There are songs written about this stuff. And we look back into the histories of all cultures, and being fruitful and multiplying is both a celebration of that, and it's a logistical tactic to make sure that you and your lineage survive. You know, if you are more fruitful and multiply more than the competitive tribe over there, you're more powerful than they are. So we've all been doing this since time immemorial. And, you know, it worked pretty well throughout history, even when we invented agriculture, and suddenly we could produce a lot more food in a concentrated place. That caused a population spurt. But we still had all these diseases on the planet that we were susceptible to, and they would tend to knock us back, because when, you know, agriculture also allowed us to do, because one person could grow so much food for so many people, you didn't need everybody to be a food gatherer. So we learned other things to do. You know, we became priests, we became prostitutes, we became architects to build dwellings so people could live, first of all, close to those fields. And then as we developed wheels and transportation, you could live farther away. And you know, all the things that happened in civilization that allowed our population to grow. But diseases and epidemics would knock us back. We'd have plagues. We'd have smallpox. We'd have all those things. At the end of the 18th century, a vaccine for smallpox was invented. And during the 19th century, that was followed by all kinds of further vaccines, diphtheria, pasteurization of milk, the discovery of antiseptic and the importance of it. Many things suddenly allowed us to live longer than the 40-year average lifespan for Homo sapiens at the time, and also to lower infant mortality. Because one of the reasons we make so many copies of ourselves in nature is that very few of them survive. Human babies, half or fewer survive to the point that they could procreate themselves. So my great-grandmother, for example, had four sets of twins and several singles. That was not unusual for women to keep having babies, and about half of hers did not survive. So in the 20th century, then we developed the means to, instead of limit our food supply that we grew agriculturally, which are dependent on some essential nutrients, especially nitrogen, which only a few plants called legumes can trap nitrogen into the soil to allow other plants to take advantage of that. You know, it's why we grow beans with corn, for example. We learned in the 20th century, around the time of World War I, to pull nitrogen out of the atmosphere. Took burning a lot of fuel to be able to do that, and then to chemically slather it on the ground. And suddenly we could grow much more plant life than nature ever could, as I said earlier. So, look, you know, modern medicine, that sounds like a great thing. More food, that sounds like a great thing, you know, but it turns out that they had unexpected consequences. The unexpected consequences mean, you know, many more human beings on the planet. I think that we deserve to be here as much as any other species, but, you know, too much of a good thing is just too much. And that's why we are pressuring the planet so much. So not only did we expand the food supply, once with nitrogen, based synthetic fertilizer, but we expanded so rapidly that famine was almost assured in the most populous areas, particularly in the Middle East. But then a further development was called the Green Revolution, where by cleverly crossbreeding plants like corn and wheat and ultimately rice to grow select for a shorter stalk so they would put more energy into producing more grains and more beans, we created harvests that were sometimes 10 times what conventional harvests would have been. But Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for founding the Green Revolution, when he accepted, you know, he won the Peace Prize because he was rightfully deemed the person who has saved more human lives than anyone else on the planet. You know, he warned in his acceptance speech that unless we couple enhanced food production with population control, that's not a phrase that's in vogue these days. Family planning is what he meant. But what he understood was that, you know, if more people don't die of famine, they will produce more people who need more food, and it's going to keep just going ad infinitum. So a lot of scientists, ecologists learned that lesson. I mentioned Paul Ehrlich before, who wrote The Population Bomb. And, you know, his career has been dedicated to how human beings can wisely limit themselves to smaller families so we can keep the species going, but not so much that we overwhelm the planet that feeds us. And you know, that's basically what we are going to have to do, or nature is going to do it too. It's just like it does it to all those locusts when they, you know, when they eat up all their food supply.
But how is it that you take, let's say, two Catholic countries where you have highly educated populations, the Philippines and Italy, with such dramatic differences in family size, and you talk about Catholicism weighing in much more heavily in the Philippines than maybe Italy?
Well, you know, the Philippines is a poor country, and it's still a very rural country. And in rural areas, families tend to have more children because they become agricultural helpers. You know, in the case of China, when it realized, you know, and it realized that it had a population problem because it had the world's biggest famine, you know, in the 60s and 70s, over 40 million people died, that when they instituted their famous one-child policy, which has since been modified, but they also began to urbanize. They started building cities and industries and attracting people to those cities where there was, you know, there was better pay. And once in cities, urbanization turns out to be one of the best contraceptives there is, because people are living in smaller spaces. Your kids are no longer an economic asset because you don't need them to go out and till the soil or gather the crops. They become economic liabilities because in a city you have to, you know, educate a child. You have to feed them to make sure that, you know, they're going to get a good job. But the other, the best contraceptive of all turns out to be, you know, educating women. I went to 21 countries to research my book on population countdown, and rich country, poor country, Catholic, Buddhist, you know, Jewish, it doesn't matter. You educate the women, and on average, an educated woman who's got now something valuable to, you know, to contribute to the economy of her family and also something interesting to do with her life. You can't do that with seven kids hanging on your skirts. So she's going to have, you know, on average, two. Because it takes two people to create a child. If you have two children in a family, population does not grow. Any family that has fewer than two children is contributing to shrinking the population. So you got, you know, I go to the Vatican for that book, but it's surrounded by this Catholic country called Italy, which has possibly the highest rate of female education in the planet, probably more female PhDs per capita, and one of the lowest birth rates because so many Italian women are professionals. And yeah, you know, the maternal instinct still exists. You want to have children, but they, you know, they generally have one, two at the most. And despite all the Vatican's pleas for them to have more, you know, in many countries in the world, that's scared. You know, you hear this particularly, there's all these white authors now that are very scared that the white population is, you know, in Europe, in the United States, is shrinking and that we have to have more babies. There's no way to bribe women to have more babies. It's been tried in Russia. It's been tried in Singapore. It's been tried in all these other countries. And sometimes the bribes are incredible, you know, like in Singapore's case, paying for the child's education throughout college and all that. Women are not interested. So, you know, I'll quickly touch on Iran since you mentioned it. Iran is the surprise chapter in that book of probably the most successful family planning program ever. And it's because, like China, they realized that they had a population explosion on their hands. After the Iranian Revolution in 1979, they were immediately attacked by Iraq. It was Saddam Hussein who wanted to grab oil-rich provinces along their border, by the way, including the top of the Persian Gulf, where I begin my later book, Hope Dies Last. The Iraq at the time was a NATO ally. The NATO provided a lot of arms, munitions, and even the components of nerve gas, which Saddam Hussein used liberally against the Iranians. All Iran had were bodies. So the Ayatollah issued a fatwa saying that, you know, it was basically a plea to every fertile Iranian woman to do her patriotic duty to help create a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders. And at one point, Iran probably had the highest fertility rate in human history, over 8, you know, children per woman. But then when the war finally ended in a truce after 8 horrific years, a very intelligent economist, and I realize that's often an oxymoron, but a very bright economist who was the head of planning and budget for Iran went to the Ayatollah and said, we're going to have a huge problem on our hands because all these kids that were born during the war, in 10 years or so, they're going to be needing jobs and our economy is not going to be able to satisfy them. And we're going to have a lot of angry, unemployed, frustrated young males. I mean, he could have been describing Pakistan, which is another country where I went for that book, which is 26 million people, It's a country the size of Texas, which is population about 26 million, only you've got a population that is rivaling the population of the entire United States right now. And so many of them are unemployed young men, which is why it's been always an easy place for terrorists to recruit because, you know, what do they have to do? What do they have to lose? So, what Iran did instead of that, they saw with the problems of the Chinese one-child policy, you know, tremendous suppression of women and enforced abortions and sterilization and sometimes even infanticide, though those cases, the number of them have probably been exaggerated, though the killing of any one child is horrific. But what Iran decided to do was instead of an obligatory policy, you know, the state coming into your bedroom and telling you what you can do, they made it voluntary. But their program was accompanied by a campaign, a publicity campaign that basically, you know, imagine billboards of a big family that's in rags and a small family that can afford, you know, to dress well and to eat well. The only thing that was obligatory was premarital classes where you could go to either a mosque or a health clinic and you could learn, among other things, how much does it cost to raise, feed, clothe, and educate a child. And then they made family planning everything from condoms up to tubal ligations and vasectomies available for free throughout the country. I talked to a conservative Muslim OBGYN, a woman who talked about how they would go mule back to all these little villages and later in four-wheel drive. And they would set up a temporary surgical theater and all these exhausted women would line up to have a tubal ligation because they didn't want to have any more babies. But the most important thing was they encouraged girls to stay in school. And for the reasons that I've already described, I mean, you got to a point where in Iran, more than half the university students were female. And they brought their fertility rate down below replacement rate. you know, down below two children per family. It's actually 2.1 to account for some, you know, infant mortality that always happens. But they did it a year faster than China with its draconian one-child policy. So it was a wonderful program. Unfortunately, in succeeding years, and I actually describe this happening when I am in Iran for that book, the politics swung in the other direction. And under a new president with a new economic advisor, he convinced the president that, oh, we're going to lose out economically unless we keep having more children. Here's a little, since you were asking about overconsumption before, this is a side note. Why do economists like big populations? Well, the easy answer is, well, more consumers for more products. But the dirty secret is that the more people you have, the lower wages are, because you have a bunch of miserable people competing with each other for any job in order to survive. If you have a shrinking population, such as Japan is having for reasons that I explain in that book, Japan's population has been shrinking since about the middle of the last decade. And you have fewer kids coming into the workforce. Well, what happens when you have fewer kids? You have to, wages rise because they become more valuable. That's the best way that we have for a more equitable distribution of wealth on this planet. You know, but you have happy workers, productivity does not necessarily, you know, wane because, you know, people are just more productive than feeling that they're in a job where they're undervalued, which is the case of most of the workforce in the world right now.
And if there's one agency, a U.S. agency that stands out, and it comes up many times in Countdown, that's at the front lines of fighting for family planning, it's a USAID. And there was an article in the news just the other day about $10 million worth of contraceptive related devices that were just sitting in Belgium. And you had organizations like the Gates Foundation offering to buy this, to allow the government to maybe even make a profit on it. And $167,000 was spent to destroy. They basically fabricated a reason why that had to be destroyed and spent $167,000 in taxpayer money to destroy those. So I don't think there's any memory of, I mean, this has been in the news recently, the dismantling of the USAID, but there's no real awareness of this. And even in this article that I read in the New York Times, there was no mention of population issues. It was strictly a budgetary thing. Well, look, isn't this a waste? This could have been purchased. Instead, we spent money to destroy it.
So one of the reasons that population is so hard to register is that the world that you were born into, yeah, that's the world as far as you know. And there's a lot of people in that world. And to you, this is what the world normally looks like. It is not normal. The human population right now is abnormal for the reasons that I mentioned. We use some artful technology to make our population explode. And, you know, again, if the planet were limitless, as the planet really effectively was through much of human history, that's how we expanded and grew beyond our African origins, you know, all the way to the Americas, which we discovered and settled around 15,000 years ago. I mean, you know, we've never been up against limits before. The concept of limits doesn't really exist in ecology until a species learns it the hard way when you exceed them. So this is, you know, it's just hard for us to understand. So in the case of USAID, I mean, USAID originated during the Kennedy years, and it was really a response to communism gaining a foothold in Cuba, in the Americas. And so we wanted a foothold we wanted a billboard for capitalism, like Cuba was a billboard for communism. So Costa Rica was the original and biggest recipient of foreign aid. And we built the biggest, what became USAID, the United States, in development organization in Costa Rica. And that's incidentally one of the things that we did there was this new thing called the birth control pill had been invented. And after some trials in Puerto Rico, when we learned what the proper dosage was, the USAID office in Costa Rica started to distribute these things. It was a very interesting situation. Their partners oftentimes were Protestant churches, which were fringe churches because most Catholic churches, most Costa Ricans were Catholic. But, again, having a lot of children is exhausting. And suddenly, with USAID backing, these Protestant churches were advertising on the radio, what, your God makes you feel guilty for wanting to have only the number of children that you can responsibly care for? Our church loves you for that. And those churches were actively distributing the pills. So this became USAID programs throughout the world, distributing family planning mechanisms. And one of the lessons that we learned through, the Chinese example, and also tragically, what we did in Costa Rica, because the idea of tying women's tubes against their will, or sometimes even against their knowledge, they would come for a doctor's appointment and they would leave sterilized. We learned to educate women. That's the best way to get them to accept family planning. And for example, in the book in Pakistan, I saw the USAID offices there because the United States is a rather volatile topic in Pakistan. The distribution of USAID materials went through local organizations. The USAID logo, the US logos were nowhere present on these things. But these were very, very effective tools. Throughout the world, the United States, through USAID, was by far the biggest distributor of family planning materials. That's materials that allow women to decide for themselves how many children they want to have. You mentioned that the history of family planning is difficult, because even Margaret Sanger herself, founder of Planned Parenthood, believed to a certain extent that in eugenics, that some populations, should procreate more than others. And it was misused for a long time. The feminist movement was, in league with the Vatican in opposing family planning, because they saw the, particularly the excesses in India when forced sterilizations under the Indira Gandhi regime were, though there were actually more forced vasectomies than there were forced tubal ligations. But now, nearly all feminist organizations have been totally, in league with, and I guess there are exceptions, because I just saw Amy Coney Barrett, give a presentation in Washington, and she considers herself to be pro-female, but also, pro-procreation. But for the most part, you know, family planning and women's liberation are one and the same. It's the most effective tool for women to be able to decide for themselves, and the loss of UAD is a tragic loss.
So in your most recent book, Hope Dies Last, you highlight all the different examples of what real people are doing, a wide range of people. And we can't control the political context, but we need to take action. And you're taking a lot of encouragement from the actions you think that you see people taking all over the globe. But at the same time, a lot of this is anchored in technology. And you yourself seem to have mixed feelings about technology. We need to try everything, I've heard you say that, but can technology solve the problems that technology has created? I see this theme of, on the one hand, yeah, we need to try everything, but technology often fosters overconfidence. It often encourages forgetting. And I thought the example of the Netherlands was fascinating, that they have actually built these museums to remind people that you haven't experienced the devastating consequences of floods for decades, but don't forget. don't. And they actually build this and take these kids. I was hoping you could comment on that. What are the dangers of technology over confidence forgetting, and how that and the example of the Netherlands?
Well, you know, you've raised a lot of questions, but going to the Netherlands is a good place to start. You know, the Netherlands is – I have a chapter set there because now with rising sea levels, the whole world is looking to – figure out how do we protect our coastlines? How do we protect our coastal cities? I mean, most of the financial capitals in the world at one point, I have a list of them in Hope Dies Last. Most of the financial capitals are coastal cities. I mean, think Shanghai, think New York, think Singapore. You know, what's going to happen when they flood? Superstorm Sandy has already given us an idea of how devastating it can be. So the Netherlands is the place that the whole world is looking to. And we've got dozens of countries now going to see how, you know, how they managed to keep from drowning over the past 1,000 years, because 2/3 of the population are living below sea level there. They are the first country to use technology basically to effectively reclaim land from the sea. You know, that's what their famous windmills were about. Those windmills were turning these buckets that they would, you know, empty the water out of a place where they had built a barrier, a dike, and then created this polder is the name for us, you know, a field that is usually below sea level that's been reclaimed. They have gotten better and better at doing it over the years, but they still had big losses. In the 1950s, they had a huge flood that a dike burst. Nearly 2,000 people died. Hundreds of thousands of cows, sheep, and goats died. And the only way that they were able to finally close that dike was to bring over some caissons, basically these big concrete cubes. They were actually long rectangles that were left over from World War II, from the Normandy invasion. They towed some of these over from Britain to basically form kind of an artificial harbor. But they towed, I think, 4 or 5 of them into place, to block, you know, to plug this hole in the dike. And today that's the Watersnood Museum. It is a museum where you go in and you are in this barrier between you between the land and the North Sea, and the whole museum and several other museums elsewhere in the Netherlands are devoted to what happens when things flood. And as a result, every kid in the Netherlands today has to pass a swimming test with their clothes on. You know, that's part of the memory that they try to instill, because Now the Netherlands has built this incredible technology. They got all these gates that storm surge barriers that are hydraulically like moving the Eiffel Tower into place to stop, you know, water from invading the land when the sea is battering it, how to get the rivers to flow in such ways that you can live among them. It's really, really amazing technology when you see all the things that they've done. Some of these barriers inflate on the spot. They're incredible. But as the Dutch engineers that I talked to were in unanimous agreement that they believe that they've got things controlled right now and that they are pretty much safe till maybe the middle of the century. And then a lot of these controls have to be revisited because the storms, as we have more of that invisible insulation above us, keeping the heat in, are happening more frequently and they're more powerful. And they're banging against those barriers, meaning that they've got to close those storm surge barriers in a way that, you know, they were designed to close in emergencies. The emergencies were much fewer and much farther apart in the past, but today they're happening much more frequently. Everybody knows. I was just talking to someone in Galveston, Texas, and he says, yeah, our 100-year floods are now like, you know, weekly events. So there are limits to what technology can do. We're going to find out what those limits are. At the same time, technology is wonderful. That's how you and I are talking to each other right now. And my book is filled with people who the one thing that they have in common is that they're very stubborn. They refuse to give up. They refuse to stop trying because they say if we don't try, then failure is assured. And it's that kind of stubbornness that I found so inspiring because, you know, I meet people from all walks of life. Some of them are just normal everyday people. Some of them are trained professionals like civil engineers or plasma physicists. Some of them are indigenous elders. Some of them are religious elders. Some of them are military people. But they are all dedicated to wanting to find our species a way to the future, and they refuse to give up trying. And some really several people were told that what they were going to try was impossible. They went against the conventional wisdom, and they tried anyway. And they pulled off some miracles. I mean, these are people who don't sit around hoping for miracles to happen. They set out to make them. And that's what we all have to become. And that's the inspiration that I got from researching and writing that book, really uplifted by these people. And I hope that the readers take that same impression away.
Alan, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you. It's been a wide-ranging conversation. And I appreciate you know, finding all these things to think about in my books.
I've been talking with best-selling author Alan Wiseman about his three most recent books, The World Without Us, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth, and Hope Dies Last, Visionary People Across the World Fighting to Find Us a Future. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. See you soon.